This essay tells a story of political marches and everyday acts of radical care, of sledgehammers and bags of rice, of the struggles for justice waged by migrant domestic workers. But before I begin, I need to come out of the closet, or more precisely, I need to come out Crip. This isn't something I've done publicly before, but it's quite simple. I have epilepsy. I'm epileptic. I've known this since I was 12, when teachers at school first accused me of giving them blank stares or drifting off in the middle of a sentence. Everyone thought I was a chronic daydreamer. But one day, when it got so severe I could barely string a sentence together, we realised I was having what doctors call absence seizures. My brain was shutting down for a few seconds several times a day. I saw neurologists and started taking medication, and I stopped having the seizures. If you take the London Underground, you might have seen new seat covers at the end of carriages with the reminder that not all disabilities are visible stitched into them. After more than 18 years of taking this medication, my disability is almost invisible even to me. So why am I telling you this? Why even acknowledge this almost perfectly hidden aspect of my brain? The word Crip has been reclaimed by disability activists from a violent slur to a term of strength and solidarity. It goes hand in hand with the idea that disability isn't a problem found in my body, but comes from the barriers that disable or disempower people with all kinds of physical and cognitive differences from having fulfilling lives. That's why coming out Crip is a kind of paradox. It is about claiming and celebrating your own body and disability, but it's also about claiming that disability is not your own. Since at least the 1970s, activists have fought for recognition that disability is about how society, its institutions, schools and buildings, for example, exclude or disable certain people. These are social systems that all of us are part of, whether we consider ourselves disabled or not. To come out Crip is to acknowledge that Crip is already out there in society, rather than in here in my body. But the truth is, I didn't identify as disabled at all until recently. Because my seizures were so successfully managed, as neurologists would say, so well hidden, I didn't feel disabled at school anymore, or later at work. I took the medication twice a day and didn't think much more about it. So all my life I've been used to passing as non-disabled. But lately I've started to think more carefully about why and how. I'm currently working as a researcher at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, using sound art as a way of listening to stories that are often ignored. For the past 2 years, I've been working with migrant domestic and care workers who travel across the world to work in other people's homes. I was forced to recognise my disability because of what they told me about their experiences. I was forced to recognise an obvious truth. I could only choose to ignore my disability because I had access to healthcare and medication for free, as a citizen of the UK with access to the NHS. If my disability was invisible to me, it's because that privilege was too. Many of the domestic and care workers that I've been doing research with migrated in order to earn money to support disabled children or relatives. A Filipina migrant, Lena's experience captures the irony of many domestic workers' lives. She's worked in Lebanon for 25 years, caring for other people's children, while her own children were looked after by her husband. But when he suffered a brain aneurysm, Lena borrowed thousands of dollars to pay for intensive care at hospital back in the Philippines. She can't stop working because of her debt, and she still needs to earn to support her children since her husband passed away. And at the same time, Lena's undergoing her own physiotherapy. When I first met her, she was wearing a foam neck brace, and placing a light finger on the back of my neck to show me what she meant, she told me she had 8 discs disaligned in her neck and back, affecting her heart. Though her condition is clearly a result of years of repetitive housework and taking care of her employer's young children, they refuse to contribute to the cost of her treatment or give her paid sick leave. Sadly, this isn't an unusual story. In Lebanon, migrant domestic workers are not covered by national labour codes, and employers often feel a sense of impunity. In the UK, too, a visa system that ties domestic workers to a particular employer leaves them unable to negotiate effectively for their rights. Caught between systems of exploitation with little or no support for workers' health, Lena and others like her are trapped in a cycle of both selling and buying care. But activists are fighting to change that. I met Lena's friend Rose on a protest in Beirut on Labour Day last year, marching for the rights of migrant workers. She was surrounded by friends and colleagues, other migrant domestic workers shouting and chanting, blowing whistles and holding placards. One placard said, "Employers, if suicide doesn't kill us, you do," while another showed a photograph of a woman leaning over a balcony and the simple question, "Why?" A shocking average of 2 domestic workers have died every week in recent years in Lebanon, often falling from balconies and reported as suicides. When Rose and I planned to see each other a few months later, I offered to meet her at Sodico Square in central Beirut, the place where the march had begun that Labour Day. We planned to make a sound walk, to record the sound of our conversation and, after co-editing it, post it online at homemakerssounds.org. Today, listeners can download Rose's sound walk from the website and retrace our steps while hearing her voice through their headphones. I use sound walk making in my research because it invites migrant domestic workers to take me and our listeners directly to the places that are most important to them, and to make careful decisions through co-editing about how they want to tell their stories. If you could walk through the same streets now, I wanted to ask Rose, what memories would it evoke? Now that the chanting and the placards are gone, how are you keeping the struggle for migrant workers' rights alive? But when we eventually met, Rose and her activist colleague Sarah preferred to sit down and talk in Sodico Square rather than retracing the route of the march. Rose had limited mobility because of pain in her legs, also acquired through years of domestic labour. "This place is so memorable," she said. "The march is a day of happiness and freedom. If you see everyone's faces, everyone's body movement, you can really see the expression of happiness and joy. And now that I'm back in this same place, it's sad and happy at the same time. Because all the effort that we did, all these things, and nothing changes." Sarah from Madagascar and Rose from the Philippines intermingled Tagalog, English, French and Arabic and spoke like sisters, teasing each other and buoying each other up in moments of pessimism. The march was the one day a year in which domestic workers could come out onto the streets in crowds to hold up placards and dance and sing to take over Lebanon's capital. "When you work behind closed doors," Rose explained, "it's worse than being in prison. That's why I use the word invisible," she added. "For the other 364 days a year, many domestic workers feel their demands and rights are going unnoticed or deliberately ignored. Why do we sacrifice every single year to march and nobody's hearing us?" she asked. I thought about the word sacrifice. Sitting with Rose and Sarah in Sodico Square, I realised what it meant to her. Walking through central Beirut isn't easy due to the lack of pavements and the pollution levels. But for Rose, it represented the additional struggle of walking. In joining the march every year, she was also coming out Crip. Not by using the word as I do, but through her actions and through exposing the disabling reality of the world she lived and worked in. Rose came out in public not despite the difficulty of walking, but because of it, to put her body on the line and to be joined by other women whose bodies spoke in different ways of the violence, whether sudden or slow, of labour exploitation. The vicious cycle of buying and selling care means that, like Rose and Lena, many domestic workers come together to form their own networks of mutual support. Back in London, I recently joined a volunteer from a Filipino cultural organisation that's supporting nurses and domestic and care workers affected by the coronavirus outbreak in the UK. We met in Battersea to deliver groceries to a house of 6 COVID-positive domestic workers who were self-isolating. The volunteer explained to me that the women in the flat had lost their jobs and were living in overcrowded conditions, unable to keep themselves safe from the virus. When you're sending all your money home to support relatives also hit by poverty and the pandemic, she told me, this is the only housing you can afford. Only that morning, I'd read yet another article branding coronavirus as the great social equaliser. But that myth depends on realities like this one being kept out of the picture. Many migrant domestic workers in the UK are informally employed and have no economic safety net. The volunteer I met told me that one woman had recently escaped from abusive employers, and though she had a human trafficking case against them outstanding, was frightened of seeking medical care for fear of being reported for not having the right papers. Unlike me, women who find themselves undocumented in the UK, through no fault of their own, are not accessing the care and medication they need through the NHS. I never got to meet any of the women in the flat in Battersea. The volunteer I was with spoke to one of them on the phone from outside their front door, and when we'd put down the bag of rice and fruit and were at a safe distance down the corridor of the housing estate, she opened the door and called out a faint, thank you. Pagaling kayo, replied the volunteer. Get well soon. The writer Robert McRuer uses the image of a group of disability activists knocking out a chunk of concrete in a street curb to illustrate what he means by coming out crip. It means taking a sledgehammer to what seems like an insurmountable barrier and radically remaking the world in a just and accessible way. Several sledgehammers are needed to knock out the barriers to justice faced by migrant domestic workers, abandonment by national social care, legal systems that let employers get away with abuse, global inequality that means women must leave their families and work in other people's homes in order to feed their relatives. But sledgehammers also take the form of marches and placards, and of late-night deliveries of rice.